thank you, Suze, very much for bringing us into being present with where we are right now, with compassion and suffering and caring. So that's where we're going to start, where I'm going to start today. The title of my talk is How to Practice in Daily Life with Social Engagement Guided by the Dharma, or the Dhamma, as we say in Pali. So this is the day, it's the last talk, Sunday Sit Talk on this topic for the month. So I'm going to talk for a less amount of time and give you more time to discuss how this practice works in your own life. And so I'm going to say ahead of time that there's four points that I'm focusing on with practicing with social engagement in daily life. And the first point is the quality of mindfulness and how important this is to our practice with social engagement. I'm also going to talk about overwhelm, which seems to be something that is a challenge with this topic, and how to choose, or how we choose our activism and the actions we're going to take to make things better. And then the role of connection in social activism. So we really need to start just like we start the Eightfold Path, with having the right attitude and view towards social activism and the importance of mindfulness in social activism. So I am guided by Thich Nhat Hanh's book, The World We Have, which I read when I was, I still am involved with the Climate Action Group. We read this book, and what Thich Nhat Hanh says is that, nothing exists. So this is the right view part. Nothing exists as an isolated self, because it is dependent upon and connected to everything else. So that's something that we in our path, just our general path, I think are growing more and more aware of how we're connected with everything else. And in one way, this is can bring us joy, but it also can bring us, closeness to a lot of suffering. So it's kind of both, but it is the reality, the Dharma. So practice in social engagement is really part of the Eightfold Path, and it's part of our widening feeling of connection and thinning of ourself. You know, there really isn't a huge difference between me and you and all beings. We start to see that connection. And I remember Rodney, when I was first trying to understand Anatta, our founding teacher Rodney, had a talk on not to. He said, have an attitude of not to, that we really aren't I and you. There's one, there's a oneness. And so that developing sense of not to is part of social activism. Another part of my practice and part of the practice of the Eightfold Path is the Brahma Viharas, being harmless, reducing harm, expanding our loving kindness. So the path of the Brahma Viharas moves us in the direction of melting our boundaries and developing more compassion And I'm thinking right now of the Karaniya Sutta, which is the discourse on loving kindness attributed to the Buddha. And the part that says, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. With a boundless heart, should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded. So that's an aspiration. And I certainly am not there yet, but I know that's the direction. So the direction of social engagement takes me out of my bubble, you know, takes me out of those near and dear to me, and encourages me to break down that idea of me, mine, they, them, the other. So it is a continuum, and it's not that all social activism has to come from the perfection, already having perfected that, but it's the direction we're going. So my practice with social engagement depends on my continuing my mindfulness practice to help me develop the discernment and balance necessary for taking right action. In the same book, Thich Nhat Hanh says, social work and relief work done without mindfulness practice cannot be described as engaged Buddhism. People who do this work can lose themselves in despair and anger or disappointment. If you're really practicing engaged Buddhism, then you know how to preserve yourself as a practitioner while you do things to help the people in the world. And so I ask myself, you know, well, in my daily life, how do I preserve myself as a practitioner while doing things to help the people of the world? How do I do that? And I really believe, and it seems to me this is what Thich Nhat Hanh is saying, that I need to really make sure that I still have my alone, secluded time for formal sitting so that I can stay in touch internally with what's going on with me, what my values are, and when those poisons are arising. And by preserving my time of inaction, it actually will support my activism. And I have seen friends who get so involved in activism that they don't have time for the meditation, you know, because they feel the urgency so much. So, and sometimes I can feel that way too. I can get really into, well, I've got to do this and this and this and this. And I'm in that productive mode that is so a part of our society, you know, fixing a problem, achieving a goal, doing it faster, and just produce, especially when I'm faced with the urgency of something I care about. So I do need to acknowledge the urgency of issues, but be careful not to get into panic mode, focusing on fixing the problem, because I soon find myself believing that there's no amount of action that's enough. And then I get, you know, it's not a healthy place. So my mindfulness practice is helpful to help me discern when it's necessary to draw boundaries, even though ultimately there's an aspiration for expanding boundaries. I have to take care of myself also. And so there's kind of a balance between caring for myself, kindness to myself, and kindness to those in need. mindfulness also helps me be aware of when the three poisons, you know, crop up in my life, especially with related to an issue I care about. So greed, hatred, and delusion, I can find myself, you know, hating the people that are getting in the way and causing this problem. Delusion, just really wanting everything to be okay. I know one of the things that is really close to me is the climate crisis. And I find myself remembering when I grew up in the 50s and we used to go camping all the time. And, you know, nature was just this haven. It was just the answer, and just brought me peace. And and it was always there. And now I find myself, you know, oh, I wish it were back in those days when I turned to nature and all I saw was, you know, beauty and God and peace and refuge. And I don't always feel that way anymore. So I'm looking at this, you know, this is something that's coming up for me. And I also want to be able to see, to separate the action from the person so that I don't add to the hatred in the world. And it makes me think of the story of Angulimala, which is one of my favorite stories. And most of you probably know the story, but I'll just re-summarize it. He's a real bad guy in the time of the Buddha. It's very hard to not think of him as an enemy because he was terrorizing the countryside. And the Buddha, he was in the neighborhood of where the Buddha was at this point. And all the people were telling him, oh, don't go out for your walk because don't go into the forest. Angulimala is out there and he's a serial killer. He'll kill you. But the Buddha went out anyway, and he did run into Angulimala. But the Buddha showed no fear, and he just kept walking at his normal pace. And Angulimala expected him to, you know, be afraid of him and run away. And of course, that's what everybody else did. And then that would kind of trigger Angulimala to chase after him and kill him. But the Buddha didn't react like normal people. And so Angulimala got more frustrated and said, stop. You know, he kept telling the Buddha to stop. And the Buddha didn't, but finally he did say to the Buddha, to Angulimala, I have stopped, Angulimala, now you stop. So obviously the Buddha wasn't talking about walking. He was talking about the behavior of Angulimala. And somehow, I don't remember the details, but Angulimala just changed at that point. And he did become a disciple of the Buddha. And the Buddha, that was it. There was no more talk about what Angulimala had done. He changed his behavior. So to me, that story shows that it's the stopping of the behavior that's the harmful behavior that's important. It's not the person that you have to destroy or punish. So to me, it brings out that guilt, blame, and hatred are not the way to reduce harm in the world. But these poisons do come up when we work with social engagement, and we need to be aware of them. Another sutta that Tweri brought up, which I think is also really important to our attitude toward social engagement and deciding how we act, is the Atidanda Sutta, which Tweri referred to, and it's called arming oneself, because danda means stick. So in this sutta, which I will actually read because it's not very long, it's actually a poem. And this is attributed to the point of view of the Buddha. So he said, Fear is born from arming oneself. Just see how many people fight. I'll tell you about the dreadful fear that caused me to shake all over. So this is the Buddha saying that. And so it's making me think that, wow, the Buddha is like me. He sees, you know, harm in the world, and it's very distressing to him. So he continues, seeing creatures flopping around like fish in water too shallow, so hostile to one another. Seeing this, I became afraid. And certainly I'm afraid by issues, the things I see in the world. And I'm thinking some of you might feel fear also when you see the things that you care about that are harmful. So he says, seeing people, the world completely lacks essence. It trembles in all directions. And he says, I long to find myself a place unscathed, but I could not see it. And I don't know if any of you feel this way, but when I look out, you know, and listen to the news and see what's happening, I wish there were a place unscathed that I could just turn to and forget about that. So then he continues, seeing people locked in conflict, I became completely distraught. Which that there goes the overwhelm. And I know that I've had issues recently that have really affected me, and that's the way I felt, completely distraught. But then the Buddha says, but then I discerned here a thorn, hard to see, lodged deep in the heart. So he turns inward to see where's the harm, where's the suffering inside him. It's only when pierced by this thorn that one runs in all directions. So if that thorn is taken out, one does not run and settles down. Who here has crossed over desires, the world's bond so hard to get past? He does not grieve. She does not mourn. His stream is cut. She's all unbound. What went before, let go of that. All that's to come, have none of it. Don't hold on to what's in between, and you'll wander fully at peace. For whom there is no eye making, all throughout the body and mind, and who grieves not for what is not, is undefeated in the world. For whom there is no this is mine, nor anything like that is theirs, not even finding selfness, he does not grieve at I have nothing. So it seems that ultimately at the base of even dealing with social activism, we're still on the same path of we will be better equipped to do something about it, to contribute, the more thin ourselves is. It's the same things we need to root out to be able to act appropriately to help the world in the bigger as well as the smaller. Anyway, that's my interpretation. What's the other thing I wanted to say about this? I guess what I want to say, oh, here it is. So we don't have to take up a stick and beat ourselves up because we have caused harm or strike out in blame, making the other the enemy. We need to go to our mindfulness practice, which helps us see the nature of the thorn in our own heart, our own greed, hatred, and delusion caused by our own clinging to I, me, and mine. And then we'll be better equipped to offer right action in the world. We need to be mindful in the beginning, mindful in the middle, and mindful in the end. Now, easier said than done. So I'm going to move on to overwhelm, which I really see as a problem. It's something we have to deal with. So it's really easy to get panicky these days when we see the state of the world and all the things that need to be fixed. I put that in quotes. So Tewari reminds us of the story of Avalokiteshvara, the god of compassion, and how he wanted to solve all the problems and get rid of all suffering. And he really worked as hard as he could for that, but he worked so hard that his head exploded. So I really can identify with an attitude like that, which I think many of us have a tendency to, you know, just be so overwhelmed by how big and complex the problems are that, you know, it defeats the purpose. You know, we don't want to destroy ourselves. So the Buddhas had compassion for him and did give him 1,000 arms and I think 10 heads so that he was better equipped to deal with his aspiration. Now, in my mind, I like that story because to me, all those hands and eyes and heads to me meant that nobody could do it alone and that we are, it is a collective, it is a group task, and we have to have an attitude that it's a group, that there are other people, there are other arms out there, and there are other heads and eyes, and we will do our part and others will do their part. It just seems like a much healthier way to look at it. So that's why I like that image of the Avalokiteshvara. It's hard to pronounce. And even if I don't know who all those people are, I have to trust that it's not just me. This is something that is a collective thing. And the other image that goes with this is the Kuan Yin image, the Chinese, of this goddess of compassion sitting in the royal ease is the pose, which I really wanted to show you these pictures, but I think most everybody's seen them. But she has her knee up, and so the idea is she's ready to act, but she's quite calm. You know, her posture is poised. And it's not like she's frantic running around in circles. So that kind of an attitude, you know, if I'm going to be useful, I need to be ready, but poised and calm. My distress is not going to help anything. So when I get in a state of distress, I need to look at that. So I like that image of her in the royal pose. So the next thing is taking action and choosing. How do you choose what you're actually going to do to help the world? So Thich Nhat Hanh says that someone came to him, a yogi, and said, "There are so many urgent problems. What should I do?" And he said, "Take one thing and do it very deeply and carefully, and you'll be doing everything at the same time." So we just need to look to our heart. What's nearest and dearest can include what makes us angry. And think, I care about your pain. I care about this pain. What one thing or doable thing do you have that feeling about? And it can start close to home. Not all of us, as Mother Teresa said, can do great things, but we can do small things with great love. So we can start there. And as we say in our community statement, freeing our minds of greed, hatred, and delusion through this practice offers the opportunity for others to do the same and reduces ignorance and hatred in the world. But it is collective action, so we do have to go outside of our smaller circle. And so the fourth thing is connecting with other people, joining forces, joining in with people who have the same aspirations and can inspiring us and support us and hear us and give us energy. And also connecting with people we're going to help. So if we have compassion towards a person or a group of people, we get from that connection, there is a kind of joy, even though we're in the midst of, you know, we're touching pain, but there's a joy in connection that we can get. And I want to close here. But there was one more thing I wanted to say. What was it? I guess I'll have to stop with that. Because I want to give you enough time to talk in your groups. We all have things to offer that are not heavy lifting. That's what Tweri said. So when we find something that really touches our heart, in the process of offering, we aren't depleted, because there's a certain amount of tenderness and connection that comes from it. So we need to find that and not be overwhelmed. And we need to continue our practice and find balance between the outward and the inward. So thank you very much. We can break into groups now. And if you would like to lead, this is a good time to do it so I can put the rooms together. And the questions that I have are, how do you balance mindfulness sitting practice with activism or action for the greater good in the world? So how do you balance? What larger social issue is closest to your heart? And how do you keep from being overwhelmed? How do you connect with others as you face the pain in the world and take action to do something about it? So you can take any of those or one of them. And it looks like there's 15 people. So if I do breakout, where's breakout? Okay, it looks like everybody's back. Would anyone like to share out what happened in your breakout group? You can just kind of go like that, or you can make a comment, ask any kind of question. Yes, Carol.
This was what I contributed. I'd like to, and this is how I reacted to some parts of your talk, Lauren, is that I'm not objective about my own experience, but when I'm looking at other people and what is the crisis, and I think that you had talked about climate change being a crisis, is that if we're doing our social activism and we've defined a crisis, then we're already in a place that's very difficult for us to handle, because we're working out of a place of fear. We're working out of a place of wanting to have control because we think it needs to be solved. And so what I would say is it's very important to determine whether this is a crisis or not, to have our facts straight, and to look at why are we thinking it's a crisis? How are we reacting to it as a crisis? And I think that first, then we are in a better place. Oftentimes, for instance, climate, there's people that disagree. They don't think it's a crisis. And how, if we're in that place of fear and wanting to have control, how can we then actually come to a place with those people? And the other thing is the camaraderie that you get from people that who have the same opinion also reinforces your idea of it being a crisis. So what is the harm? Is there harm being done? And what is the harm? And how much harm? In fact, this was a question that we came up with. How much harm is done when we try to help, but we're not helping?
Yeah, you bring up some really, really important things to reflect upon. That's why mindfulness is so important. Yes. Because there's so much emotion, fear, we don't come to most of these issues within a state of calm. So I like the fact that you pick words like crisis, because and our use of it, and what does that, how does that affect people, that word crisis? And so our attitude towards the issue that we, that engages us, that we say, this is something I really care about. And how we talk about it and the words we use. So I think you bring up, I don't have any answers, but I know that I just say crisis because in the group that I'm in, that's what they say. We want people to know this is a crisis. So there's a part that we want the urgency shared, but then how do people respond in that situation? So communication is really important. And guess what our topic is for next month? Communication. So we're going to get into this. So stay tuned. Oh, yes. So Jean or John, I think you need to unmute.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting question. I just wanted to say something else related to what Carol said. It seems to me that it's not, that it could be a both and situation. You know, I mean, I feel that what's going on with our climate is an absolute crisis. But if that word throws us into like a kind of shutdown mode, then that's, of course, that's not helpful. But I don't have an answer either, but can we find a balance between actually seeing what reality is out there and having the presence to actually step in and do what we can do? To me, it seems like it's not one or the other.
I have heard, and it may or may not be true, that the Chinese symbol for crisis is the same as the symbol for opportunity. So sometimes you can look at crisis as an opportunity.
Thank you. I have heard that also, but I didn't think about that when Carol shared. But Jean, I agree with you that it's not necessarily, it's just worth exploring. It's worth exploring and understanding how the word crisis and the urgency and the maybe unsolvability and, you know, the dire situation, all those kinds of expressions of reality, if people are expressing it in that way and seeing it in that way, is it possible to be faced with urgency, crisis, etc., and still have access to joy, have access to peace, still have access to being useful? And that is something that I left out of my talk, but an example is when I have looked at in the world and seen people like the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh, who certainly are connected to the pain of the world, but they are not without joy. They're not without, they're not frantic. So I kind of look at them as like role models. And also, how do they do that? You know, how are they able to be facing things that to me appear very distressful? Certainly they are connected to them and are not turning away. They're present to them. And still there's something that is not destructive, you know, that is not overwhelming. So, yeah. Yes.
So it just reminds me, and I'm paraphrasing, it's a Christian concept. You have to let go in order to receive. And I think it's what kind of Jean was talking about. I guess I'm saying we have to get to that place of letting go of the result in order to have the result happen. And that is the real challenge, I think, in the meditation with respect to something that we feel very strongly about and, in fact, has a crisis, dire predictions, whatever. How do we get to a place? And I think you were saying, how do you do have joy and whatever within this sense of emergency, crisis? And that's the real challenge, I think, in terms of meditation, to get to that place.
I think that's part of the thorn in the heart that the Buddha was talking about.